Good evening, this is Mark Lynch and this is Everything. My guest tonight is Amanda Vail, writer and journalist on arts and culture. And we're talking about her new book that she edited and wrote the commentary for, Jerome Robbins by Himself. Selections from his letters, journals, drawings, photographs, and an unfinished memoir. Amanda, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, I'm so thrilled to be here, Mark. Thank you for calling me.
Now, you have previously written a biography of Jerome Robbins called Somewhere. It was published in 2006. This is very different project. There is so much in this book that it takes... I had to go back and reread sections because you could follow his conversations with different people throughout the decades. In some case, how did you put all of this together? Talk to me about the process of putting all this stuff together.
Well, I didn't. When I started to work on this, I thought here is a man about whom no one knows the fact that he actually was a quite extraordinary writer, and here is a man who is pretty private and whose process, work process, thought process, personal process was something he pretty much kept to himself. But on the page, he really let it rip.
Right.
So I thought, wow, this is a chance to show him as he was. This is a chance to show a side of him no one even knew existed. But when I was thinking about how to put it together, what I thought was, I don't want this to be a kind of traditional from the papers of X kind of book. I didn't want to do, here are the letters, here are the journals, here's something else.
Yeah.
Because that, first of all, you would have to, going in as a reader, I think, feel, oh, this man is somebody whose work, written work, I want to know about. And you don't know that about him. And secondly, he was always trying to tell his own story in one way or another. Most famously, or maybe not famously, but most notably, in his autobiographical theater piece, the Papa piece, which was never produced, but only done in workshop at Lincoln Center Theater, in which he tried to come to terms with his whole life, his conflicts, the things that he cared about, all kinds of things. And he had been writing autobiography for the previous two decades, some of it extraordinarily revealing and moving, I thought. And so I thought, well, why not put all this stuff together like an autobiography? And in fact, although, as you know, when you are trying to talk about his childhood, there isn't a whole lot, despite the fact that his mother saved virtually all his juvenilia, there isn't that much of that. But he wrote memoirs about his childhood, which are quite extraordinary. And so you have those, and you can fill that part in with the memoirs, and then you lighten those up with little letters that he wrote as a child or poems that he wrote as a child. And then as you move along, you see different parts of him. And I saw the whole – the other thing was that Robbins loved collage as an artist.
Well, his journals that you reproduce in the book – I was wondering if there was going to ever be an art exhibition.
Well, there should be, because there was actually a Robbins exhibit at the Performing Arts Library this last year, but it was very much about his life, his work, his this, his that. There could actually be simply an exhibit devoted to his graphic work.
Right,
because he really was a very, very visual person, as anybody who worked with him knew, and he was a quite talented artist. He was a good watercolorist. He was a very deft line artist. He had wonderful color sense, and this collage business, he did one whole diary that was nothing but collage. I mean, he put the whole thing together. As a child, he did a book for his mother that was poems with collaged, cut out images from a book of Greek myths that he pasted into the thing. And I thought, oh, this is perfect. This is the form. I will make a collage out of what he left, because a lot of it is pretty fragmentary. Anyway, they're fragmentary memoirs. They're They're diaries, but they're not continuous. So, you know, if you take a little here, a little there, you put it all together, you end up with something kind of a cinematic collage of his life.
And it's in his voice.
And it's all his voice. I didn't want to interrupt that. That was very, very important. At one point, my editor said to me, well, of course, you could put stuff in between this entry and that entry. And I said, no, I am not going in there. I'm going to do little introductions for each part
That's
of this
right.
book. I'll divide the book into kind of, you know, the ages of Robbins. And I'll have a little intro, which is going to say, okay, during the next few years, this and this and this happens. You're all good to go now. And I'll hand it over to Jerry. And then I did. And I also put in footnotes literally everywhere in this book. I've never written so many footnotes in my life.
I was gonna mention that because you sort of run out of symbols for the footnotes per page.
Yeah, I was really like, ooh, are we into the, you know, double asterisk?
That's right. Yeah, that was like wild. But the amazing thing is that it works. The incredible thing is the form works. And so you get really sort of a self-narration of his life.
Yeah.
And just before we go on, just for the benefit of the audience who may be too young to know who Jerome Robbins is, from your own book, I'll just quote, he reinvented the Broadway musical. He created vernacular American ballet, won 4 Tonys, 4 Donaldsons, which predate the Tonys, 2 Oscars, an Emmy. But then he worked on so many shows that people are familiar with, it's sort of mind-boggling. He worked.
Oh, it is.
You know, I started mentioning things like he co-directed The Pajama Game. He
mm-hmm.
doctored Cole Porter's Silk Stockings. He worked on West Side Story.
He invented West Side Story.
He invented it. There was Fiddler on the Roof. The list is going on, and that's not even
right.
his ballet.
Peter Pan, which generation of Americans was huge. And
I was of that generation. I was born in the 50s. I grew up with that Peter Pan, and it's just
an amazing.
Yeah, and then the list is sort of endless. However, there were all these other issues going on in his life, and you mentioned the Papa piece. For a while, it took him a while to get comfortable with his Jewish heritage.
Yes, it did, and I think a lot of this came from the fact that his very own parents. His father was a first-generation immigrant. He came to America from a shtetl in what was then Russia and, you know, has been various other things since. And his mother was a first-generation American. I mean, I guess she had been born here. She didn't immigrate. But they were extremely focused on having their children be assimilated. And while they maintained a certain kind of secular Jewish identity, they were really very focused on making sure that their kids were Americans. And
that's right.
So this already set up a kind of ambivalence, I think, in Robbins' psyche as a child and in his own desire to fit in, to be a part of the world that he felt his parents wanted him to be a part of and that he wanted to be a part of. He wanted to push away what he said was dirty, smelly,
right.
Kind of old-world Jewishness, which he just hated. And for when he was 13, he was going to do his bar mitzvah, and an old tzaddik came to the house to teach him Torah and, you know, get him to learn to say his Torah portion and do this and this. And the schoolmates teased him right. about this, and it was unbearable to him. And instead of feeling like, I'll show them, he just thought, this is horrible. This whole thing is horrible. And when the old man didn't want to even notice that the friends were teasing and jeering and looking in the window at them, he thought, this is the most horrible thing in the world. This man is teaching me Jewish submissiveness. I don't want this. I don't want to have anything to do with it. So he pushed all of this away. He just didn't want to have anything to do with any part of it until really he got to be a middle-aged
man.
Well,
you mentioned a book that he read that was critical for him changing his sort of a change of being for him to finally accept who he was.
Yeah, well, it was oddly enough, this is a book by a man who was, I think, an Irish Catholic called John Murray Cudahy, but it's called The Ordeal of Civility, and it was a book about the what the burden of assimilation on European Jews, essentially in Germany and Poland and Northern Europe, and the terrible psychic trauma that in a way this is upon them. And Robbins read this and thought, that's it. Oh my God, that
right.
is it. That
right.
is where this came from and this came from. This is terrible. Maybe I should go back and reexamine my Jewishness. And of course what he was recalling at this time too was his own childhood visit to his father's ancestral shtetl in what was at the time that he went to it, Poland, and is now Belarus, a place called Rajanka. And he wrote about it in the most elegiac, beautiful terms. It's like this kind of Jewish Arcadia. And you just think there's this amazing, beautiful place where you are loved, where everything is beautiful. It was all lovely, he says in his memoir about it. It's absolutely ravishing. And I think he called on those feelings when he came to do Fiddler on the Roof.
Now, again, we're going to just skip around because there's so much we could talk about. Mm-hmm. I could just talk about individual journal entries. But one of the big things that happened in his life, which was to haunt him literally his entire life, is that he named names to the House Un-American Activities Committee. Now, what comes out in this book, and he writes in his journal about this, is the role that Ed Sullivan had in this. It sort of sounds like Ed Sullivan almost blackmailed him into doing this.
I mean, he did, actually.
I mean, he threatened to out him. Basically, he threatened to out him is what he did.
Yeah, he did. What happened was that Robbins was going to appear on Sullivan's show, a Sunday night variety show, which was like the great Sunday night ritual.
I can remember it well.
Of America.
That's right.
I mean, Bye Bye Birdie has a whole song about this, Hymn for a Sunday Evening,
right.
which is all about how everybody in America sat down at their television set at 8 o'clock on Sunday night and watched Ed Sullivan, and they had dancers and singers and popular entertainers and jugglers and who knows what, and they were going to have a ballet by Jerome Robbins with members of New York City Ballet and Robbins himself dancing because he was a quite notable dancer in his youth. And then Sullivan found out, because this was the 1950s and the Red Scare is everywhere,
right.
He found out that Robbins had been a member of the Communist Party in the mid-40s. And he hauled him into his office, along with a guy called Ted Kirkpatrick, who was the editor-in-chief of a Breitbart-type rag called Counterattack. And he basically said to him, I cannot have you on my show unless you go straight, you confess all, you tell everybody that you did this, and you should name names too. And Robbins refused at first to do this. He was willing to call everything himself.
Right.
But what he would not do was he would not name names. And indeed, for 3 years, he managed to avoid getting swept up in this net by skipping town during subpoena season and going to Europe and hiding out in Europe and in Israel in the summertime and not returning until after all the subpoenas had been served and, you know, he was free and he didn't have to say anything. Finally, and I talk about this in the biography, I don't talk about this in this book too much because, and certainly Robbins himself never mentioned this, but two sources told me, who were contemporary sources, friends of Robbins, relatives of Robbins, actually, told me that Sullivan had said he was not only going to expose Robbins as a communist if he didn't cooperate and name names, but he was also going to expose him as a homosexual.
That's right. That's right.
And the problem with that was not really so much that Robbins was upset about being outed as a gay man, because really at that time in the theater,
right,
in the ballet world, you know, it was, this was a whole gray area, and it was not something that was going to cause him that much of a problem. But what was going to cause a problem was that there were people he had been involved with, notably Montgomery Clift, with whom he had had a long, mostly on-again, but sometimes off-again, affair in the late 40s and early 50s. And Clift was at that time on the absolute fast track to big stardom, and it would have been homicide, career homicide for him to have that happen to him at that time, to have him associated, oh, well, you know, he was associated with Robbins. We know what he is. He is not actually the, you know, America's sweetheart that we were trying to put him, sensitive America's sweetheart that we're trying to put him about as being. So Robbins caved, and he did name names. And
it bothered him for the rest of his life. I mean, there are entries much later on in the book where he has a nightmare, and he still is it feels horrible about the fact that he did it.
And there's that one little snippet that he, when he was called for jury duty, in, you know, the 1980s or something, and he says, just having to name, you know, state your name and hold your hand up and say, yeah, you promised to tell the truth, the whole truth. He that was just horrible to him. It was like a, you know, ghastly flashback to the moment of actually being in the hearing room. But what was so odd and characteristic was that, however, at the time, he never wrote about it to anyone. He wrote letters to people within weeks and days of those hearings. He never said, I'm really, you know, dreading appearing before a HUAC. He never said anything about it. He didn't write about it at any great length. The only thing he did was to write this long memorandum, essentially to his files, which was a kind of statement and summary of exactly what had happened to him with Sullivan and Kirkpatrick, which I believe he had done in order to have it for reference in case he ever needed it to defend himself legally. And as it turns out, I mean, he apparently did not pull this out at that time. But he did pull it out years later to use it as a kind of aide memoir when he was writing the Papa piece and writing a kind of surreal trial scene in it, in which the protagonist, who is very much like himself, is being given this kind of nightmare show trial by a bunch of people who want to find out whether or not he was a member of a subversive group. And he must have pulled this memo out to kind of use it as for background, because he then filed it away with all the duplicate scripts of this theater piece. Nobody ever saw it, and it was buried in the archives. I never saw it when I wrote his biography. None of his other biographers ever saw it. Nobody had ever seen it. And I went into his archives to pull out. I was looking for one of the varying scenes that he had written about this trial. He wrote several versions of it, and I was looking for the best one because I thought, well, since I don't have any account by him of this hearing in which he testified, but it was so important to him that he talked about the repercussions in his diary years later, I need to have something that will stand for that in this narrative of his life. And I thought, I'll use a scene from the Papa piece. I'll use one of the trial scenes. And I found one, and I think it works really well.
Right.
But at the same time, while I was doing it, I discovered this kind of wad of paper in among these other folders. And I thought, well, what's this wad of paper that I have never seen in my life? And I pulled it out, and it was this 30-page memorandum that he had written. And it was just a bombshell from, you know, a 50-year-old bombshell, more than 50 years, a 70-year-old bombshell. Incredible.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Amanda Vail, writer and journalist on arts and culture. And we're talking about her new book that is just phenomenal. She edited and wrote the commentary for Jerome Robbins by himself. Selections from his letters, journals, drawings, photographs, and an unfinished memoir. Now, that's not the only weird piece. There was a letter to himself written January 12th, 1989.
Yes. This is the other
that just was found recently that's included in this book.
Well, this is one of these wonderful little surprises, and I just keep feeling like the guy is up there somewhere. He's still pulling the strings, you know. He's a director. Don't let us forget. The guy is a director, or he was a director. And I keep thinking that he's directing the whole thing, because this is what he did. When he had been working on Jerome Robbins Broadway, which was his last Broadway show. It was a jukebox musical of his greatest hits, from numbers from all the musicals that he'd done over the years. And it won two Tonys for him. It was put on in 1989. And this is a man who always had a kind of ambivalent feelings about his own work. He was always self-doubting. Oh, it's not good enough. I'm not happy with this. Kvetch, all the time. So he went to a preview performance after he'd been in rehearsal for a gazillion weeks on this show, and he came home. He took out a sheet of his Jerome Robbins 117 East 81st Street stationery, and he wrote himself a letter. He wrote himself a letter that said, "I am so pleased and proud about this show. It has surpassed my wildest imagination. It makes me so happy to see what's going on that stage. I'm so proud of my own work that I could die happily tonight." Isn't that,
it's amazing.
And you then...
What happened to the letter?
And he sealed it up in an envelope, a Jerome Robbins 117 East 81st Street envelope, and he stuck it in, I think, a souvenir program from the show, one of those big, you know, things with all the photographs of the production. Well, the program got picked up at some point, stuck, you know, somebody was tidying, and it ended up in a suitcase that went down to the basement in his townhouse. And then, you know, he died ultimately in 1998, which is like 11 years later. And his housekeeper was given a bunch of things from that. And she said, "Oh, I'd love to take that old suitcase of Ms. Robinson's. I think that would be great. I might use that someday." Well, she didn't use it someday. She didn't use it someday until about 2 years ago or a year ago or whatever when we were putting the book together. And she opened the suitcase, and here's all this stuff in it. She said, "Oh, my God, what's all this?" And there was this letter. It was like, you know, message in a bottle.
There are so many good parts of this book.
So incredible.
There are things, thoughts on choreography. There's incredible notes to Leonard Bernstein and Arthur Lorentz. But what was funny is he would just write letters to people like Ingmar Bergman. Was like he didn't even know Ingmar Bergman, did he?
No, I think they might have met once and shaken hands, but that was it. And he wanted to work on a film. He'd had an idea for something that actually was, he wanted to do a film about Nijinsky. And he had very sort of, he was thinking about what form it would take. He wanted it to be very different. He didn't want it to be a, you know, sort of basic biopic type thing. And he decided, the person who would know the best about the kind of film that I would want to make about this would be Ingmar Bergman.
Wow.
So I'm going to write him a letter and just say, you know, "Hi, how would you like to talk about this?" And apparently Bergman, you know, did not blow him off. He wrote him back and said, you know, "That's, yeah, great. I'd love to meet with you." But then, you know, for whatever reason, they both had very complicated schedules, and the meeting didn't happen, and so much for that. But I just thought, whoa, that's an incredible.
It was an amazing thing. But there's a lot of examples of things like that. There's so many great pieces in this book. There are notes on Barbara Streisand and Funny Girl.
Oh, yeah. He just loved her.
Oh, my God. That was like, that's so great to read that.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Now, we were talking about, we have minutes, by the way, left. We were talking about his sexual orientation, but he also married and had long relationships with women. But the most fascinating woman for me, you probably know who this is, Tanaquil Leclerc.
Yeah.
I sort of want to read her biography.
Well, it's being written, actually, by a wonderful woman who was a friend of hers in her late life, called Holly Brupa. So, you know, sit tight, everybody, because there will be a Tanaquil Leclerc biography. She is the most fascinating figure. This being a documentary film about her, but she, oh, she was something else.
But the big part thing is she gets
so madly in love with her in a way that was, it transcended everything. It transcended sex. It transcended gender.
It was amazing.
Everything. And he said, when he was talking to somebody years later, every ballet I ever did, they were all really for Tanny, because he just felt she was his muse, and she's stricken tragically with polio,
and she's in an iron lung, and he's still writing to her almost every single day, and she's dictating the letters back because she can't write, obviously.
No.
And what an incredible series of communications that was that's in this book.
Well, what I thought was so extraordinary about them, and he wrote her literally every day. I mean, literally. And they were, and he had them special deliveryed to Denmark. And at the time, he was in rehearsal for, and then supervising the opening of Bells Are Ringing. Then he, because she and George Balanchine, to whom she was married, were living, they were stuck in Copenhagen, where she had been stricken with polio on tour. And so he's trying to help out with City Ballet. And then he's starting with the initial run-up to West Side Story, all the casting and starting the rehearsals for that. And even so, he's writing to her every day. And what's so moving and funny to me about those letters is that, or moving, I guess, is really what they are, is that he's trying to bring the world to her.
Right,
he describes everything.
Right.
It's like she's stuck there. She can't move. She's in this hospital room. So I'm going to take everything to her. I'm going to tell her all the gossip. I'm going to tell her everything I've seen, every art exhibit I've gone to, every movie I've gone to, all the gossip about everybody, every funny party I went to, how somebody got drunk and threw up all over my shoes. he does all of this stuff. And censored limericks and poems and anything just to amuse.
That's right. There's limericks in this book. Amanda, we're completely out of time, and we could talk for like hours about this book. We have literally only scratched the tiny surface of this book. I had like five other pages of questions to talk to you about. My guest tonight has been...
Well, maybe we should just do a sequel.
We could. We actually could. My guest tonight is Amanda Vail, writer and journalist on arts and culture, and we're talking about her new book that she edited and wrote the commentary for. It is spectacular. Jerome Robbins by himself, selections from his letters, journals, drawings, photographs, and an unfinished memoir. Amanda, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been more than that. Thank you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.